Good evening, everyone, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. My guest this evening is, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, Y. Shawley, who has written a book called You Are What You Love. She is part stand-up comic, part spiritual teacher, and full-time soul stripper. She gently caresses with wisdom and understanding the purpose behind human life on Earth, why we don't have love, we are love, and that if you change your perspective, you will change your world. Y. Shawley has been enormously influenced by the 18th century mystic Emanuel Swedenborg, whose brilliant wisdom is the central core of her spiritual practice, and the remarkable Oscar Wilde, one of my own personal favorites, which is where she says she gets her indivisible sense of humor. So let's find out more about this wonderful, funny lady right now, and welcome Y. Shawley to the show. Hello.
Thank you, sweetheart. It's such fun to be here with you.
It's fun to be here with you, too. Well, you know, the first thing I noticed about your book, I expected something kind of dry and dull, and, you know, I mean, you never know what a book is going to be like when you start to read it, and all of a sudden I'm, you know, laughing out loud. And you have an irreverent and wonderful sense of humor.
Thank you, darling. The last thing I wanted to do was put out another dry, arid piece of spiritual philosophy. I mean, there's plenty of people that have already cornered that market. I wanted to share something that people could relate to in their everyday life. That's why I've got, you know, Cheech and Chong examples in there and Jimi Hendrix examples. Because people need something that they can relate to. And I think that people learn, they understand better if they're laughing, if they're engaged, if they find it something that is, you know, not so serious that after they put the book down, they need to go to their Surgeon General and get a stickectomy. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. Well, I guess I'm kind of like you. I find humor to be a healing energy.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't know if there was there was more to that thought, but yes,
no, there wasn't any more to it. That was that it just fell out and it landed on with a big thud.
If you're laughing, it seems to me that your mind is in an open position and you're not so completely contracted around a certain point of view that you can't consider an open dialogue.
Who are some of your favorite humorists, just before we get into some of the more serious things about your book?
Well, we brought up the big one, the amazing Oscar Wilde.
Oh, yes.
So do you have a favorite Oscar Wilde quote?
I probably do, but I don't have it at the top of my head. But what's yours?
We could be here the rest of the evening
talking to
some of mine, but my most favorite is alcohol taken in sufficient quantities produces all the effects of drunkenness. And the English have the uncanny talent of turning wine into water. And, of course, you know, some of the ones that probably people are more familiar with, I have the simplest of taste. I'm only satisfied with the best.
Oh, he had a million of them, didn't he?
He was just an incredibly stellar, brilliant mind.
Yes, yes. Yes, he definitely was. I remember when I first started reading some of his plays and you know, just howling with humor because they were just, you know, obviously this he was a genius, a comic genius.
And I think his stuff still, you know, 100 years later.
It holds up.
It's completely timeless. He's actually in my book quite a bit. As a really an example of a remarkable life and a remarkable life lived with all the principles that I'm applying in the book. I bring out a completely new definition of forgiveness because I think our old definition of forgiveness is stale and we've exhausted it and it's disempowering. Mm-hmm. And forgiveness should be empowering. Mm-hmm. And his ability to forgive, to grow beyond what hurt him, is remarkable. For him to lose everything the way that he did.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And for him to still, on his deathbed, have this incredible sense of humor. Either the wallpaper goes or I do.
Yes, that was his last line, wasn't it?
And to me, that is, for him to have lost everything,
Yeah.
And to become homeless and penniless. And he died from spinal meningitis, and a lot of his, he had lost a lot of teeth, and he was covered with sores. I mean, it was clearly in a tremendous amount of pain. And for him to still have the presence of mind where his last words were, I'm going to duel to the death with the wallpaper. Either the wallpaper goes or I do.
Well, you know, he, I guess in a, in a, in some kind of sense, he was a champion for, a forerunner for the modern gay rights movement. You know, this was long before, you know, people would even acknowledge sexuality, and, you know, drawing room humor was very subtle and it had to be couched, and but it was understood, and he just simply flaunted his experiences, and people weren't ready to accept that.
He was definitely the poster child for gay rights, and I think that most people today are shocked and astounded when they find out that the way that he ended up going to jail was he was tried and convicted of gross indecency, which is basically one male having a relationship with another male, because the same law did not apply to women. And that the British government decided that this was a heinous enough offense that they legally felt entitled to completely confiscate a person's entire property and intellectual rights and then stamp them an unfit parent for the rest of their life and never let them see their children. I mean, how horrific.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely relate to that, and, you know, I hear about things, you know, I'm gay, so I don't usually talk about it or admit it on the air, but, you know, when the subject comes up, I don't mind, you know, sharing that if it's appropriate, and I'm surprised to hear that people are hung in other countries for just for being homosexual, and it just sometimes it seems like we live in a very barbaric time.
And this is kind of... The point of the book is my favorite mystic, Emanuel Swedenborg, who apparently also had a very good sense of humor, although he's not famous for that like Oscar Wilde. He says that a lot of our neuroses and our psychoses and our fears and our inappropriate behavior, such as the narrow-mindedness and bigotry that you and I are talking about, that is a reaction from an insecure mind, that all of that comes about when people do not know who and what they are. And when people know who and what they are, these type of insecurities and fears evaporate from the mind and nervous system, because that kind of limited reaction, that kind of... myopic response to life and to relationship cannot coexist in a mind that knows who and what it is.
Very good. You know, I'm not really that familiar with Swedenborg. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about him and his life and his thoughts.
I would adore to, and you know what?
What?
Most of your listening audience has never heard of him either.
I did a little research. I did a Google. And, you know, I'm always amazed when somebody comes up with a new, an amazing new philosophic genius that I've never heard of. You know, I'd have heard of Einstein, but I'm sure, you know, when I was in school, I must have heard of Swedenborg, but he didn't stand out. So I'll let you do the, since that's your area of expertise, you can fill us in on this one.
And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you got an advanced degree and didn't hear of the guy. He was, I call him the best-kept secret of spirituality, and I think, quite frankly, it's a crisis of consciousness that we know more about Paris Hilton than we do about Swedenborg.
Thank you.
And when I get done explaining everything about who he is and what his big life purpose and claim to fame is, I think that most people in your listening audience will say, yeah, there's something not quite right here with how we value human brilliance, that we know more about how much Nicole Richie weighs than we know about the gifts of Emanuel Swedenborg. But He was born in 1688 in Stockholm, Sweden.
Wow.
And he died in 1772.
Wow.
So he died in his 80s. He actually had a, you know, a fairly long life for his era.
Hmm.
And he started out his life, he was born the son of a Lutheran bishop, and he started out his life mastering every known science.
Oh,
and I want to preface this by letting your listening audience know that when he started mastering every known science, science was very much in its infancy. And it was really hoped at that time that science was going to take us collectively to a place that was going to allow us to resolve issues and questions that people felt religion had not done adequately. And at that time, to be a scientist was very much a state of innocence. It was very much a posturing of, I don't know. I'm going to let reality tell me something about its self-evident nature.
Wow.
As opposed to today, a lot of scientists mean, you know, I know it all, you're
right.
Stupid, get out of my way.
Right, right.
But that's not what it was about at all in
wow.
his time. And he studied with Sir Isaac Newton.
Whoa.
He studied with Sir Edmund Halley, the astronomer that Halley's Comet
oh,
is
yeah.
named after.
Yeah.
He mastered every known science in his life. And when I say he mastered every known science, I don't mean to just say, you know, he was a really smart guy that did a lot of incredible things. I mean the guy mastered every known science in his life.
Wow.
He wrote 4 volumes on the human brain,
oh
came up with
goodness.
The most accurate drawings for his era. He figured out what the cerebellum is for, what the pituitary gland is for, what the endocrine system is for. He figured out the relationship between respiration and the nervous system,
wow.
between respiration and the movement of spinal fluid.
Huh.
He came up with the first working hang glider, the actual first working hang glider, long before, 100 years before the Wright brothers. It hangs in the Smithsonian. He came up with a blueprint for submarine. He was a metallurgist.
Huh.
He came up with mining safety techniques that were used 100 years after he came up with them.
Wow.
And Sweden's economy was really swirling around the drain when he took on metallurgy. And he really, with the mining safety techniques, really brought a shot of resurgency to the Swedish economy.
Uh-huh.
His government came to him and said, look, dude, we got this little problem. We got our Navy over here. And we really, for strategical naval purposes, need for our Navy to be over, way over there.
Uh-huh.
But the problem between where they are now and where we need them to be is that there's this big, jagged mountain range between the two.
Huh.
Can you move them? And he moved their entire Navy.
Wow.
He wrote over 150 scientific works on color, fire, soil, unit of measure.
Wow.
People who have been profoundly influenced by him, just to scratch the surface, Carl Jung, most of the basis of what he understands about dream and collective consciousness, he learned from Emanuel Swedenborg.
Wow.
Ralph Waldo Emerson was hugely influenced by Swedenborg, as was the great Zen Buddhist teacher D.T. Suzuki.
Wow.
He wrote a book about Swedenborg called Buddha of the North.
Huh.
Helen Keller, her book, My Religion, is all about Swedenborg's concept on spirituality. Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, William Blake, William James, Henry James, just about every single person that we consider having their fingerprints molded Western civilization was hugely influenced by this man.
Wow.
Yet most people have never heard of the guy.
Yeah.
Now, when he was a few years ago, Stanford University decided that they wanted to come up with a list of the top 10 most brilliant people who ever lived. Because you know these eggheads are sitting around with nothing to do but come up with top 10 lists like
right.
David Letterman.
Right.
So they wanted to come up with a top 10 list of the most brilliant people to ever draw breath on the planet.
Uh-huh.
And Emanuel Swedenborg and 2 other people tied for first place.
Wow.
He's in the Guinness Book of World Records for having one of the largest IQs.
Ooh.
And to tell you the truth, all of this stuff that I'm sharing with you, none of this is what impressed me about this guy.
Uh-huh.
That's not what got my attention about him, because there's lots of smart guys out there.
Right, right.
What got my attention is that when he was alive, people would say, Okay, so, like, what's with the terminal overachiever, dude? Why are you mastering every known science in your life? What is that about? And the answer that he gave them is that he needed to know where the soul resided in the human experience, and that's what he was after.
The old soul question.
It wasn't to be considered a reputation as the smartest guy that ever lived.
Right.
It wasn't to get more kudos with because he was a member of Sweden's parliament as a statesman. He was driven by the need to know where the soul resided in the human experience.
Interesting.
And that started to pique my attention.
Uh-huh.
Then this pushed me over the deep end. He said that since he was a small child, he'd been able to control his breathing and enter into a trance-like state of supreme concentrated focus, which is how people suspect he did all these scientific stupid humor tricks. So when he was 56 years old, he was doing this meditation, controlling his breath, entering into this trance-like state of supreme concentrated focus, when he said the veil between the physical world and the spiritual world dissolved.
Really?
And he was able to talk to spiritual beings.
Wow.
And human beings with the same clarity, the same certainty. And for the remaining 27 years of his life, he had one foot in the spiritual realm and one foot in the physical realm, and he wrote about how the spiritual world works, how it operates, how it organizes itself.
Really?
And he said that he was given permission to do this, and that the whole beginning part of his life as a scientist was actually training for him to go into this dispassionate ability to describe the spiritual realm. Because I don't know about you, my love, but if that was my job, because I have the thing for the color purple, first thing I'd be writing about is, well, you know, obviously these spiritual creatures aren't too evolved because their underwear isn't purple and they don't like laughing as much as I do. You know, I would be very swayed in my perspective, but he was incredibly dispassionate, and he was also very attentive to what some people have called a minutia level of detail.
Oh, my.
He wrote over 35 volumes of work on the spiritual realm. He wrote over 3.5 million words.
Wow.
With no Google, no spell check.
And probably just a quill.
Just a quill. And he was just cranking these books out.
Wow.
And people said to him, because he didn't put his name on them when he first started writing them and then paying himself for them to be published.
Huh.
And when people figured out he was writing these, and I'll tell you the story about how people figured out he was writing it, because that's a really great story, too.
Oh, good.
He didn't deny it. I mean, he wasn't doing it to be deceptive.
Uh-huh.
He said, yeah, I'm doing it. And when they said, well, why don't you put your name on it? And he said, well, it's not like I want to put out the notion that I'm authoring this.
Uh-huh.
It's more like I'm taking dictation.
Oh, wow.
And
so
he was actually
channeling.
Yes, what we would now call channeling.
Yeah.
And he was actually sussed out, flushed out, if you will, by the Greek philosopher Immanuel Kant.
Oh.
A man not famous for his sense of humor.
No. No.
And the way that he was discovered is Emanuel Swedenborg had traveled some 200-300 miles from his home in Stockholm. Because, you know, he's a man of influence, and he travels in very influential circles, and he's at one of these shishi parties, and Immanuel Kant is in attendance, and he becomes very agitated, and he keeps getting up from the dinner table and walking out into the gardens and pacing, and the host and hostess are concerned that perhaps somebody said something offensive to him, so they went and checked in with him. And he said, oh, no, your guests are lovely people. That has nothing to do with that. He said, what's agitating me is there's a fire that's burning out of control in Stockholm right now. and it's destroyed a big part of the city, and it's clearly out of control. A friend of mine's house has been burned and destroyed, and it's headed towards my home where all my writings are.
Ooh.
Now, you got to bear in mind, this is the 1700s. I mean, he wasn't getting this from CNN.
Right.
There's no cell phones.
Right.
There's not even telegraph. There's not even wireless.
Right.
And Marconi hasn't even begun to be a gleam in his grandfather's eye. And so, obviously, people are quite astounded. How do you know that 300 miles from here there's this fire going on? And Immanuel Kant hears this, and he overhears this conversation. And when they ask him, how do you know that? Swedenborg was very honest. He was very straightforward. He said, well, I talked to the angels, and the angels are telling me this is happening right now.
Wow.
So Immanuel Kant is thinking, oh, Mr. Angel Boy talks to the angels. Isn't that adorable? So he starts taking notes about what Swedenborg says about this fire, where he says it started, how it started, where he says it's traveled. And a couple of hours later, Swedenborg lets everybody know it's good news. The fire's out. Did an incredible amount of devastation. It actually got a block or two away from my home.
Huh.
But it's absolutely, definitely out. My home is safe. My writings are safe. It's all over.
Huh.
So it took several weeks, obviously, for the news to get from Stockholm to where Immanuel Kant was.
Right.
And when the news finally got to him, he took out his piece of paper that he took as notes on Angel Boy and found that all the details about the fire matched exactly.
Wow.
And that's what started to pique Immanuel Kant's interest in him. And there's a lot of other stories I could tell you that are called minor miracles. When people realized that Swedenborg could talk to the spiritual realm or talk to people who had crossed over, they came and asked for information. And there's a lot of great, wonderful stories called minor miracles. Swedenborg never wrote about them because he didn't consider them important. He just considered them kind of stupid human tricks. He considered what he wrote about to be important, and that's what he wanted people to focus on, not that he could talk to angels. And if I could condense, which I can and I will and I have and I are, if I could condense the heart of what he has to say, it starts out in the title of my book, and it's a spiritual law. It's not just a groovy name for a book, but it's also a spiritual law, and this is a spiritual law. You are what you love, and you love whatever you're giving your attention to. If I could condense it to the heart of what I would want your listening audience, my reading audience, the world at large, if I could condense it to the heart of what is the most critical for us to understand, and what Swedenborg is teaching is that our consciousness is indivisible from love itself. And when we're giving our attention, our consciousness to something, we are imbuing it with the most powerful force in the universe, which is love. And therefore, you want to really be very judicious about what you give your attention to, where you allot that flow of energy to reside. Do you really want to give it to something like, my butt is so big it's creating its own gravitational force field? Do you really want to give it to something like, I don't have enough time, I don't have enough money, I can never do anything right, a five-year-old in a coma could have done better than I did? I mean, do you really want to give it to things that are limiting? Did you come to this planet to build a monument to the power of limitation with your love? Because as Swedenborg says, here's the bottom line, there's no payoff in it to ever give your attention to anything limiting. But it seems it takes us a tremendous amount of time to get that.
Yes, yes. Yes, absolutely. What were some of the spiritual elements that he talked about? I mean, you know, in your reading of and study of what he came up with, what did he actually see on the other side?
He says that the spiritual world and the physical world are mirrored worlds of each other. And that everything that exists in the physical world has a spiritual counterpart, because this world is not real. It's a reflection of that world. So everything in the physical world corresponds to something in the spiritual world, though not everything in the spiritual world is in the physical world. There's more in the spiritual world than there is here.
Right, right.
And he says that everything is organized by your affection, by your love. And he says that on the other side, when we die, there is no judgment day. Now, you got to imagine, he's the son of a Lutheran bishop. He's coming out and saying, God is incapable of getting angry at you.
Right.
God is incapable of judging you.
Right.
Incapable of it, because God is only pure, unlimited love. God is not capable of any limited reaction or limited response or limited perception.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to imagine this totally shaked up the church.
Well, you know, it just seems that that's not how it's getting interpreted today for some strange reason. Something got twisted along the way. And, somehow a judgmental, wrathful God got emerged from somewhere, and people are stuck with that horrible image.
Isn't that the truth? And,
yeah.
And one of the things Swedenborg says is, there is only one God. There only ever has been one God. There only ever will be one God.
Mm.
So it doesn't matter what you call that God. You can call that God Allah. You can call it Buddha. You can call it baby Jesus. You can call it
Mother
Shiva. You can call it whatever you want.
Right.
It doesn't matter. If you're giving your attention to divine love and wisdom, you're worshiping the one God.
Right.
And that gives us an invitational space to a tremendous amount of tolerance.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Instead of, you know, trying to establish my God's better looking than your God, my God's stronger than your God, it allows us a tremendous amount of compassion and patience to really explore with our brothers and sisters, how is it that you practice touching the face of God?
That's beautiful.
And to get more out of how each tradition has a richness in creating an intimacy with this thing that we are, in the crudeness of language, calling divine love and wisdom.
Right, and instead of finding all the places that are different, why not look for the places that are areas that you can unite and agree on?
Because there is actually tremendous more unification than there is diversity, which is one of the points I'm trying to make in my book. I'm using Emanuel Swedenborg as the infrastructure to the book, because I feel that he says things really, really well, and if I could, you know, steal somebody else's words and say it better, I would have stole from somebody else, but he was the best person to steal from.
It sounds like it.
And I'll explain how Swedenborg says it, and then I'll say, now, this is how Buddhism says it.
Okay.
This is how Sufism says it.
Yeah.
This is how Taoism says it.
Yeah, I like
that.
This
is how Mystic Christianity says it.
Right.
So most people we know have been brought up in one tradition, so they're used to just hearing one lone voice cry out in the wilderness.
Right.
And what I wanted to bring people is a richness of the complete choir.
Yeah.
That depth, that melody. So I'm using Swedenborg as a template, and then bringing in how other sacred traditions, trying to paint a picture that imagine that spirituality is a wheel, and each one of these sacred traditions is a spoke leading to the center of the same circle.
Uh-huh.
And some of the other things that Swedenborg says is he describes there being three levels of heaven, a middle world, which is where we live in the physical world, and three levels of hell.
Oh.
Now, nobody in the Western world had talked about levels of heaven and hell, which is one of the things that D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen Buddhist teacher, when he started reading Emanuel Swedenborg, said clearly, this is the only enlightened Westerner I have ever read.
Huh.
Because Buddhism and Taoism and Hinduism all recognize levels of heaven and hell, but nobody prior to Swedenborg had. And he says what differentiates these levels is, again, your love, because you are what you love, and you love whatever you're giving your attention to. This everything keeps coming back to this idea. And he says that there's this concept called a ruling love. And there is, to tell you the truth, there is many different ruling love as there are people on the planet, but it's broadly divided up into four ruling loves. And the highest ruling love is a love for divine love and wisdom.
Okay.
Living to give your attention to divine love and wisdom because that's what you love and not for any other reason. Not because there's a payoff for it. Not because somebody's going to give you money or status or exciting sexual favors for it,
right?
But because that's what you love.
Right.
Then the second willing love is your love of neighbor and love of service. Then the third ruling love is a love of nature and things in the environment.
Okay.
And then the last ruling love is a love of self. And when I say a love of self, I don't mean I know how to take care of myself. I eat, you know, healthy food. I get appropriate exercise and rest. I mean a preoccupation with your self-entitlement, like one of the characters from The Sopranos. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And that all of us have free will. He said that divine love and wisdom has reigned, has created all spiritual life so that free will reigns. Because giving your attention to divine love and wisdom is only a joke if you don't also have the freedom to not give your attention to divine love and wisdom.
Which is what's happening today.
We have to have the freedom to decide where we
right.
want to give our attention.
Right.
So he says that you have the freedom to give your attention anywhere that you would like. And that he says that how we live our life very much affects how we experience the afterlife.
Yes, that would make sense.
And he says that when we die, we all go, regardless of how we've lived our life, regardless of how we paid our income tax or
right.
whether we were a pedophile or we knew how to coordinate our accessories, we all immediately go to the highest level of heaven.
Oh.
All of us.
Huh.
And he says, we don't all stay there.
Oh.
And he says, but we don't leave because somebody says, excuse me, there's been a mistake made. You really weren't supposed to come in this gate. You're really assigned a different, you know, quadrant of the afterlife.
Right.
It says nobody evicts you from the highest level of heaven.
Okay.
He said how you lived your life is going to determine how comfortable you are there.
Oh.
And if you're very accustomed to worrying and justifying worrying, you're not going to feel comfortable in the highest level of heaven because your drug of choice is going to be denied you there.
Yeah.
Because there's not going to be anything to worry about.
Right, right.
Or if yeah. you're very much one of these kind of people that feels like they always have to look over their shoulder. I got to look out for number one. I'm going to get you before you get me.
I know a few of those.
You're not going to be comfortable there either because there's none of that type of behavior going on there.
Right.
And he says that when we die, we still are able to smell and to touch and to see and to feel, and we have a spiritual body very similar to this one,
uh-huh.
so that our transition is a kind and a gentle one, so it's not shocking.
Uh-huh.
And that when we cross over, according to your love, your ruling love, if you have a very low ruling love, when you get to heaven, it's actually going to smell bad to you.
Huh, interesting.
And you are going to get out of there as quick as you can, and you're going to seek lower ground as fast as you can.
Interesting.
And you're going to seek like-minded company of people that have the same ruling love because that's your comfort zone.
Interesting. Huh. Very interesting.
Now, aren't you glad you asked?
Yes, I am. Well, it sounds a little bit similar to another guest I had on who talked about that when we cross over, that it's like walking up the steps, and we continue walking up the steps of light as far as we're comfortable, and there's a point at which we're not comfortable. And well, guess who that was? That was our great and glorious Don. Well, I'm glad he likes it.
So am I, sweetheart, because I'm telling you, he's a tough act to follow.
Oh, I'm telling you, you should have heard his show before us. I'm telling you, they were doing dolphin calls and all kinds of crazy things.
I can't top that. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Basically... when we cross over, we walk up the stairs of light, and then we find the level that we're comfortable with, and, you know, when it's too bright, the light's too dense, then we stop where we're comfortable, and that's where we're at for a period of time, I guess. But you were talking about the idea of heaven and hell, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about that because so many people have so much baggage surrounding those words.
Yes, don't they, though, darling?
Yeah, and I guess what you're doing is you're softening it a little bit by saying that these are vibrations or energies where people reside and live and feel comfortable and evolve through. Is that what you're saying?
I adopted Swedenborg's definition of heaven and hell because,
okay,
again, if somebody said it better than he did, then I would have stolen their words instead of his. But he says that heaven is a place or a state of being that is unlimited.
All right.
And hell is a place or a state of being that's limiting.
Like here.
yeah. And that's exactly what he says, is he says you don't have to die to know there's a heaven and hell. You can experience it right here, although what we experience here is not the true heaven or hell, because the true heaven and hell are non-physical states of existence.
Right.
But, I mean, you, with this definition, heaven is unlimited, hell is limited. Usually when I give public talks, I tell people the first thing I want to do is apologize for the fact that I'm probably not doing justice to your baggage around those words, and forgive me straight out for that. But Swedenborg says that God didn't create hell to punish us.
Right.
That's an incredible misunderstanding.
Okay.
He said we actually created it when we won't go to an unlimited place.
Oh.
We created it because we have to have free will and have to have an alternative, because God is going to take us kicking and screaming into an unlimited realm.
Right.
If we don't
want
to go there, we don't have to. But we created it so we would have someplace else to go when we won't let go of our petty limitation, because we think there's some justification in giving it our attention.
Right.
And that the whole point of coming to the earth is that you get a body. And he says that a body is the fastest way to excel spiritual evolution. He said because when you take a body, you have this little thing called a nervous system.
Yeah.
And that gives you immediate feedback as to whether your attention has fallen on something limiting or unlimiting, because here you have to feel the truth of it.
Yeah.
I call the earth the Keep It Real arena. Everything here is designed to keep it real. What are you doing with your love? What are you doing with your love? What are you doing with your love? You have to see it. You have to feel it. You have to live it.
Yeah.
It comes back at you and reflected in every way that is inescapable.
Yeah.
So it keeps us honest on a moment-to-moment basis about what we're doing with our love.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's giving us a free will arena to upgrade at any time should we choose to do that.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, it seems like a lot of times it takes some kind of shock or hardship, you know, to get us out of ourselves and to cause us, like a near-death experience or an out-of-body experience, to get us to look at our lives and actually turn from materialism into a more spiritual realm. Didn't you have some pretty disturbing incidents that kind of shocked you into another direction?
You know, definitely, if somebody were to distill my life to two words, they probably would not come up with charmed life.
Right.
That probably would not be the first two adjectives they would come up with.
Right.
When I was born, I was born with this birth defect on my face.
Oh.
And it made socializing with other children very difficult because, you know, kids aren't really
wicked.
Incredibly loving and accepting of other children that physically look defective.
Oh, yes.
And when it's on your face, it's kind of out there.
Wow.
And I had a lot of cosmetic corrective surgeries done, but it had to do with surgeries involving muscular structure. And as you can imagine, you're not really completely done growing that area until you're, you know, late teenager, early 20s.
Geez.
So it was still visible over the course of my growing up. And my parents divorced when I was 2, which is not incredibly uncommon. My mother remarried to a guy that, let's just say that they shared a passion for alcohol consumption.
Oh, yeah, mine too.
And as you know, when one parent is drinking, it makes life challenging. But when both of them...
are.
There's no safe place. They both have a tendency to be very critical and they can be violent. And
oh, absolutely.
You're always waiting for the other shoe to drop.
I was walking on eggshells my whole life.
Yes, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
And my dad was a Jekyll and Hyde drinker, and my mother was the quiet, reserved one who just kind of tried to, you know, smooth everything over. And I was empathic, and so I felt everything, you know, to the very core. So I can totally relate to your experiences. Probably many of our listeners can.
Especially when you're a child, your empathic core is just so completely exposed.
Oh, yeah, raw.
And also the house we were living in at that time was haunted, and I think that disembodied beings kind of fed off of their alcohol frenzy, and
mm-hmm.
there was probably a synergy there that kept them all worked up most of the time.
Yeah, same
but,
here.
When I was eight, I went to live with my dad and his second wife, and she had a drinking problem, and he didn't, she did, and when I was eight, I went to live with my dad because the family life was so stressful. I could barely read, could barely write, had a speech impediment.
Oh,
I was 8 years old, and I couldn't write my full name. I could only write my first name. I didn't even know how to write my last name.
Wow.
And there was a teacher who took me aside who wanted to bring me up to speed because I was the only special child in the class.
Uh-huh.
And so she took me out for like a year and a half. And had a lot of one-on-one and taught me phonetics and how to read and how to write and brought me up to the rest of the class level. And I spent a lot of time with her, and she was incredibly patient and incredibly loving. And I really felt like I needed a mother figure because my dad's second wife, God bless her, she's a lovely woman. She did the best she could, but she just, when she married my dad, she just, there was an agreement that she wouldn't have to raise his other family.
Yeah.
And things just disintegrated with my biological mother so badly. My dad at some point said, look, I got to renege on the agreement, and I got to take these three extra kids on, which she did not want. She only wanted her own child.
Huh.
There's no judgment there. I can imagine it was a terrible position for her.
Yeah.
And she just made it clear that every day that we were not her first choice to have in her life.
Right.
And she was very much a Jekyll and Hyde drinker, too. And,
ooh.
And so you never knew what you were going to get when you got home, especially if my dad was on a business trip.
Yep.
And so I made this teacher that spent all this time with me. I remember thinking that I needed a mother, and I remember thinking she is just the perfect person to fit that bill because she's nurturing, she's never going to get mad at me, she's never going to hit me, she's not going to call me a loser and a failure.
Uh-huh.
This is the perfect woman. And it was not long after that she was horribly murdered, and this is in the late 60s, early 70s, and the person that did this murder wanted to make it look like it was kind of Charles Manson satanic ritualized thing.
Wow.
So I don't even think I need to go into the graphic detail of it.
No. I think we get it.
Yes. And that was just so stressful that this happened to this woman.
Wow.
And I remember that I went amnesiac for a while because I remember when I was told what had happened, I was walking around saying, well, I'm so glad I didn't know her because this would really freak me out to know that somebody that I knew this happened to. And I remember all the other kids looking at me like, what are you talking about? You're the special kid. She's the one who spent more time with her than anyone else. And you don't know who she is?
Wow.
And then a few years later, they caught the guy that they thought had done it. And so there was a resurgence of attention around it.
Oh, my God.
And that's when I realized, oh, my God, I've suppressed her memory for years because I just could not take on one more stressful thing.
Right, right.
And when I got into my 20s, I was diagnosed terminal for the first time. I've been diagnosed terminal twice, once from an illness and once from an injury. And during this time of being diagnosed terminal, I was in what I was under the impression was a committed relationship. apparently, I was alone in that. And
ain't that the way it goes?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And it turned out that he was sleeping with some women that were supposed to be my closest women friends, and they all knew that I had been diagnosed terminal. And
oh, my God.
I just thought that it was really poor taste for them to not at least, you know, have the good taste to wait until a couple of months until I died.
That's tacky.
That is that is absolutely the epitome of tacky.
Bad taste.
And I was unfortunately working for his parents at the time, and they very much of the mindset that you just take whatever abuse your partner gives you, and you should be happy to get it.
Right.
So they did not take kindly to my breaking up, so they fired me.
Oh, geez.
And I was looking at having no income, no insurance. That was, you know, in the days when you have a pre-existing condition and you can't be reinsured.
Right.
And that was during that period of time. That's when I discovered Emanuel Swedenborg.
Oh.
And that's when I realized that all my entire life, up until that moment of being diagnosed terminal, I had become a professional worrier. That was my drug of choice.
Oh, wow.
Everything up till that had taught me that the first thing I need to do is run all these series of what if that happens and how do I crisis manage that.
Uh-huh.
And that I was literally giving my attention to something so limiting.
Right, right.
There was nothing in it to sustain my life, literally.
Wow.
But at that point, you know, I was in tremendous amount of pain, the kind of pain you would jump off of a building to get out of.
Yeah.
My internal organs were degenerating, and when your gut is rotting out in your body, it is really unpleasant.
I can imagine.
And I figured, you know, I got nothing to lose. I'm slated to die anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I might as well try this. You are what you love, and you love whatever you give your attention to, and see what kind of effect that has.
Uh-huh.
And needless to say, 20 years later, I'm still here.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, clearly you're supposed to be here because you have such a wonderful message, and it comes through so clearly. You know, I mean, it's just an amazing story, and I'm sure that you're just telling us the tip of the iceberg. I'll have to have you back again to get some more of the details. But now, for all the people who are professional worriers out there, myself included, how do you start to turn the tables on, you know, mundane concerns that are probably never going to happen and learning how to follow your passion and your bliss?
There's a couple of perspectives I'd like to put on the table.
Oh, good.
I'm going to start off with one that people are going to find the hardest, and then I'm going to supplement it with some other perspectives that I think will kind of brace you in getting behind the bigger one.
Okay.
When people say, how do you stop? Worry is an addiction.
Yeah.
Like any other, you're in the habit of responding to the stimulus of life this way.
Yeah.
How do you tell somebody that's an alcoholic to stop being an alcoholic?
Yeah, you can't.
You tell them to stop doing the hand-to-mouth with
right,
alcohol.
Right, right.
They've got to stop taking in that drug. How do you stop worrying? The first thing you got to do is you got to go on the wagon. You got to stop that drug, and you can.
Okay.
Now I want to supplement it with perspectives that I found really helpful, and all of these I learned from a guy I call my boyfriend.
Oh.
Emanuel Swedenborg.
Oh, okay.
You know that joke about men have a woman in every port?
Yes.
My favorite joke is, I have a man in every dimension.
Oh.
So I've got a boyfriend with a body. I've got one without one. I've got a boyfriend, Oscar Wilde, one with a sense of humor. Anyway, this is some of the things that really helped me master not going to that limited place with my mind.
Uh-huh.
Swedenborg says, I want everyone to understand you do not have love. You don't have love. Love is not a possession. It's nothing that could be taken from you or lost or stolen. You don't have it. You are it.
Huh.
It is inseparable from you. Now, there may be some people in your listening audience who are saying, well, I knew that, but I challenge you. When you put on an outfit and you say, this makes my butt look big, when you go on a bad date, when you go through divorce court, when you're going through bankruptcy court, when you lose an important legal trial, do you know at that moment you don't have love?
Yeah.
You are it.
Yeah.
And Swedenborg says, now follow this with me.
Okay.
If you don't have love, you are it. That means, as love, you are also in alignment with divine consciousness. because when was love and divine consciousness separate? And he says, now follow this with me. How can God create a learning experience of itself it didn't need?
Huh.
He says, now there's a lot of things that love can do, there's a lot of things that God can do, but create a learning experience of itself it did not need is not one of them.
Right.
And he says, what he learned is this. Everything that we are doing is exactly what we need to do to reach enlightenment in the fastest, most efficient way possible. If you needed to be learning it differently or a different way, you needed to be wearing something different, married to somebody different, living a different place, doing something different for a living, in order to reach enlightenment faster, you would be. So stop shooting all over yourself. Stop ifing. You're only going to create what you need when you need it. And you can't create a learning experience you don't need before you needed it.
Right.
And you can't create it after you needed it. And he says, only what you need to reach enlightenment is ever allowed to touch your life.
Wow.
If you don't need it, if it doesn't serve your higher evolutionary benefit, it's not allowed to show up on the radar of your life.
Wow.
He says, because divine love and wisdom is the most powerful force in the universe, and it runs everything.
Wow.
That means it wins. It gets to decide what happens.
Uh-huh.
And the best example I have of this when I do public speaking or teaching is I'll say, any of you out there know, are you in a family yourself, or you know of a family where cancer runs in the family?
Oh.
You ever know or notice that some people get cancer, some people don't? Then there are families where no cancer runs in the family, and some people get it, and some people don't.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah.
Those people needed that invitation to grow. Everything that happens to us is an invitation to grow. Swedenborg says that in answering the question about why do bad things happen to good people, Swedenborg says, you know, God doesn't want bad things to happen. God doesn't want suffering to exist on the planet, but we have free will, and we can take ourselves down the road. And the only reason that God tolerates its existence is that he promises within that are the seeds of a greater evolutionary gift, a more profound growth. And you pointed it out yourself so beautifully, my love, when you so eloquently flushed out the truth that isn't it amazing how suffering actualizes us and catapults us into a level of self-realization and self-honesty that it seems complacency does not provide.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like a slingshot effect. The further down you go the tubes, the more the rubber band snaps in the other direction if you allow it to go there. I mean, you either snap out of this existence entirely, or you completely, your life is completely altered and into another direction. At least that's what's happened in my life.
Because we came to the planet Earth to learn and to grow and to experience ourselves. And when you go that slingshot, look at how much ground you're covering.
Mm-hmm.
Look at how much experience you're taking in.
Mm-hmm.
You're exponentially expanding upon your learning. You're taking a greater advantage of being here and having a body and covering more ground. That's why there's absolutely no judgment on the other side.
Yeah.
Because the idea is to come here and have a variety of experiences.
Yes,
to cover
exactly.
as much ground as you can.
Exactly. They're just experiences. There's nothing to be judged. And, you know, I really like how you placed emphasis on right relationship with trust in order to be healthy and happy. Do you want to talk a little bit about trust and why it's so important?
Trust is really the cement here in concretizing this ethereal spiritual stuff that we've been pontificating, concretizing it into an actualized way that has a practical force and a practical value in your life.
Yeah.
When you trust, I don't have love, I am love, you are now actualizing it as a grounding agent in your life that allows you to kick out insecurity, that allows you to kick out self-criticism, that allows you to start really getting your hands on all the limited ways that you have habitually organized your attention and move it away from you.
Mm-hmm.
When you trust, you cannot create a learning experience you do not need. Now you can finally start learning from fearlessness mm-hmm. as opposed to fear-riddled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It really, because we could talk about all the stuff and we could make it airy-fairy and, you know, we could language it up and doll it up in a way that articulate it in a way that sounds intellectually nice. But it's all hand-waving if it doesn't pull your butt out of the fire that your life is in.
Right.
And I just happen to feel that as a spiritual teacher, one of the things heaven wanted to offer me is a smorgasbord of fires from which to extract my derriere. Because there's very few forms of suffering out there that I haven't already been through, that I don't already know from firsthand experience how to remove your butt from. I'm not talking, I read this in a book and I heard if you apply A to B, you get C.
Right.
No.
You lived it.
Yeah. I had to pull my butt out of that fire.
Right, right.
And trust,
burned,
is,
huh?
Trust is what starts making it a practical agent in your life where you've got some kind of value in your life that moves you forward mm-hmm. when it seems like everything around you is crumbling.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make sense, sweetheart?
Well, it makes sense to me.
Of course, you're already there, darling.
I hope it makes sense to some. I mean, I know so many people that are in the position where they just don't know where to turn, and you know, it's like I'm at a loss to say anything, because until they come to the conclusion that they need to make a change, there's nothing that you can say. You know, because we have free choice, and sometimes there's a payoff in remaining in unpleasant situations.
Yes.
And so, you know, until the payoff is not there, you realize that you're getting a payoff in those negative feelings, you can't see what's happening, and you can't see the forest through the trees.
You know, I think everybody can relate to being in that predicament, and when I find that people that I know or love or cancel are in that predicament, first thing I usually tell them is, look, you can't create a learning experience you don't need.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if there's still a payoff in it for you to go to this limited place, you still feel there's value for it, you cling to it until the day that you decide there's nothing in it for you.
Right. Right.
Because you can't create a learning experience you don't need, so have at it.
Right.
You're timeless, you're immortal, there's no judgment, you came here to learn from it, it's yours.
Well, you know, we're coming to the end, and I want you to tell people how they can find your book and your website.
You would go to Purple, because I got a thing for that color. Purple V. V is in vivacious.
Okay.
V is in very. PurpleV.com. Or you can get it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, but I encourage everybody to go to your local bookstore and order it.
Oh, wonderful. And it's called You Are What You Love.
You Are What You Love.
And why don't you say how you pronounce your name so I can get it?
Wishali.
Wishali. I said it right.
You did.
Well, Wishali, I really thank you for being on tonight. You are just absolutely marvelous and an inspiration to us all.
Thank you so much for playing with me, darling.
I'd love to play with you again sometime, too.
I'd adore that.
Okay, good. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Gracie.